last month or so, how it might be used in the future. And if there are any students in the audience, you know, take what I say with a bit of a grain of salt in terms of projects to work on, because I might be, this might be like the children's crusade where I think you all worked up to the Holy Land and the slavery and driving taxi cabs because you can't get a job. So, anyway, a lot of this is sort of long-term stuff, but there's lots of interesting analysis and geometry issues along the way, lots of pretty stuff, even if nothing of substance and format that comes out. So, I mean, I can justify it on that, those grounds alone. Anyway, so that's a warning at the beginning. So, I can't sue me in 5 years down the road from misleading you. Okay, so let me start today's this morning's lecture by talking a little bit about four dimensions, just sort of outlining what we know and what we don't know, and then I'll say introduce sort of some of the notions in symplectic geometry and explain, hopefully give you an indication of why symplectic geometry might help clarify some of the questions that were asked. So, the basic question is, the basic issue, if you want, in four-dimensional topology or in four-manifold topology is to list all, well, okay, smooth four-dimensional numbers.
Okay, so I put that in quotes because listing is actually, you can't really do that, but what we mean is this, you fix, so these manifolds, I mean compact, let's say oriented, connected, that goes without saying now. And so what I mean is this, you fix the topological type of a four manifold, so this is what I mean by topological. To be a manifold, every point has a neighborhood with a coordinate chart that identifies that neighborhood with R4. And if you have two neighborhoods, two charts that overlap, then on their overlap, you get a self-map from one region in R4 to another. We'll call that map G. And to say it's a topological four-manifold is just to require G to be a homeomorphism. So it's 1-to-1 and onto, and its inverse is 1-to-1 and onto. To say it's a smooth manifold is to say that G is infinitely differentiable and its inverse is infinitely differentiable. So if you want to do calculus, you need to do smooth manifolds, if you, you know, do physics or whatever you're doing. So smooth manifolds have a sort of natural intrinsic interest, maybe more so than topological manifolds. Okay, so the idea then is you fix some topological manifold, let's call it X hat, so it has some topological structure, and then you want to ask the following question. You look at the set, let's call it DX hat, which is the set of all smooth, X is smooth, and X is homeomorphic to X hat. And then you divide out by an equivalence relation, which is the diffeomorphism. So X is equivalent to X prime if and only if there exists some smooth invert map 1-to-1 and with an inverse that's smooth and 1-to-1. So that's sort of the set that you want to list, and the question is, what can you say about this set if you fix a given X hat? And so the bottom line is that I don't think there are any four manifolds that we know what this set is. Okay, I mean, the simplest possible four-dimensional manifold would be the four-sphere S4, and nobody knows what, has any clue what that is. Okay. We know it has at least one element, but we don't know anything else about it. We don't know whether it has two elements in it or just one element. Okay, so that's sort of the state of the art, which isn't very high, as you can see. Okay, now you might ask, well, what about topological form manifolds? What can you say about those? See, are there two boards here? Just one board. Okay, so just to give you a little background, so Friedman classifies, really, this happened now, jeepers, 20 years ago. 20 years ago, Friedman classified, how many, you guys are under 20, by the way. How many are under 25? Yeah. All right, good for you. Okay, so Friedman classified topological four manifolds, which is, if we consider the fundamental group, pi 1, to be trivial. So he did it for small fundamental group. It's still an open problem for big fundamental group, but in particular, for trivial fundamental group, that means all loops at a base point, all one-dimensional loops, can be pulled in continuously. Then the classification is determined by three pieces of data. Well, you can look at pi 2, or which is in this case the same as h 2. That's two-dimensional homology. So with z coefficients, so pi 2 is maps of two-dimensional spheres in modulo the sort of homotopy equivalence. And so this is some group with some rank, which we'll call B2 for second Betti number. So that's some abelian group. But that's not the only piece of classification, because there's a there's an intersection form. There's a bilinear symmetric form on here. And how this thing works, if you have a smooth manifold, which we're going to be talking about, you look at two smooth surfaces which represent the same class, and they might intersect, and if you perturb them a little bit, they'll intersect transversely. And since we have an oriented manifold, and these surfaces are oriented, then you can assign a plus or a minus 1 to each intersection point, depending on whether the orientations give you the orientation of the ambient four manifold or opposite. And so then beta of a class of a surface sigma and a class of a surface sigma prime is just the sum of the intersection points of these. And then you can see that this number is independent of the surfaces you choose. That's sort of pretty easy to see that. So anyway, the data then is this intersection form, which always turns out to be invertible over the integers. It's unimodular. Determinant is plus or minus 1. So there's this intersection form on H2. So the data that classifies topological manifolds that even... there's actually one other piece of data. There's a Z2 invariant also, which is called the Kirby-Siebenmann invariant, KS, which can be thought of as a plus or minus 1. So there's basically two pieces of data. There's an intersection form of some rank up to change of basis, and then there's this plus or minus 1, and that's the whole story. And in fact, the plus or minus 1, KS, has to equal 1 if beta is even on the diagonal. Okay, so beta is even, it has to be 1. If beta has some odd entries on the diagonal, it can be either plus or minus 1. And so that's sort of the classification and of simply connected manifolds. It's just this algebraic data. So, for example, the four-sphere... This is, of course, has no second homology, and so beta is a trivial form. So there's only one topological four-sphere. The next possible case is complex projective space CP2 with its complex orientation. This has B2 equal to 1, so it has one element, beta is just 1. And then there's a KS minus 1 version of this, which still works. Yes. How robust it is, yep. Okay, so then there's a KS minus 1 version of this. And there's S2 cross S2, which has B2 equal to 2, beta equal, is it off diagonal, so that's with the natural basis, like that. Then that you could take, for example, CP2 connects some its orientation reversed cousin. So if you change the orientation, you change the sign of beta. So put a bar over it means changing the orientation. This also has B2 equals to 2, but here beta is an odd form. It has 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So connect sum, by the way, if you have two four-dimensional manifolds or two manifolds of any dimension, what you do to make a connect sum is you take out a little disk in one or four ball, take out a four ball, and then there's these three-dimensional boundary spheres, and you just attach a cylinder to these, and that's the connect sum. Okay. Anyway, and you can go on. For example, a more complicated intersection form is you get from algebraic surfaces. So there's the K3 surface, which is a complex surface given by in CP3, so in homogeneous coordinates, complex coordinates, it's this sitting in CP3, which is C4 minus the origin modulo the action of the non-zero complex numbers, which is CP3. Okay, so that's the K3, and this one has a complicated intersection form, which I can't even write, but it's the matrix for the group E8, the Cartan matrix for E8. There's another copy of the Cartan matrix for E8 there, and then there's a 0, 1, 1, 0 here, and then there's three more of those. And everything else is zero. So E8 is the Cartan matrix for the Lie group. Anyway, and then there are more complicated ones you can, of course, write down. Okay, so those are some examples. And what do we know about these being smooth? Well, there are various theorems that you can prove. So first of all, dx hat is equal to is empty if the Kirby-Siebenmann invariant is minus 1. So that's a theorem of Kirby and Siebenmann, basically. So you can forget all the minus 1 cases. The other classical theorem in this regard is that dx hat is empty if beta is even on the diagonal. For all x. And the signature of beta, namely the number of plus eigenvalues minus the number of minus eigenvalues, is not equal to 16 mod, 0 mod 16. Okay, so it has to be, for algebraic reasons, 0 mod 8. If it's not 0 mod 16, there can't be a smooth thing. So this was proved by Rocklin a long time ago. And then there are the sort of results of Donaldson, which say, for example, if you take D for the intersection form E8 plus E8 plus some number K of these guys, k less than 3, that this is empty. So there are no smooth examples here. So that was proved by Donaldson using gauge theory back in the Dark Ages, 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Okay, and now and then there's sort of various generalizations of this. For example, there's the most sort of general thing one can say is that dx hat is empty if the signature, the absolute value of the signature of beta divided by the second Betti number, the rank of the homology, is greater than 8 over 10. So this is proved by Furuta. And the conjecture, by the way, the conjecture is that it should be 8 over 11, but at present it can only get 8 over 10. So anyway, that's the sort of stuff we know about which of these are empty. Given that a D is not empty, the question is how big is it? So, for example, there are lots of examples now known where D is huge. So, for example, D for the K3 surface is infinite. Okay, so there are examples where it's known to be infinite, but the exact structure of this D we don't know. I mean, we just can construct lots and lots of things. I mean, D, this is always countable for a compact manifold, but it's in fact infinite. And I might show you some of these non-trivial, non-complex K3s. So anyway, that's sort of the story. So that's sort of where we know, what we know. And now you could ask, well, the question is, how can we make a kind of coherent picture of what this is all about? I mean, how can, you know, here we have a list of examples. Some cases it's empty. Some cases it's infinite. Most cases we don't know anything. You know, is there a consistent theory? Is there a consistent even conjecture of this story? So let me tell you what sort of some of the old conjectures were. And then I'll tell you where we stand now in terms of conjectures. So the original sort of way people were thinking back before Donaldson's work was based on the analogy with Riemann surfaces. So if you look at oriented two-dimensional manifolds, there's, you know, the classification is just by the genus, number of holes, so this would be genus 0, 1, 2, etc. And one way to prove that these are the smooth two-dimensional manifolds is to use the fact that every two-dimensional manifold that's oriented has a complex structure. So this is to say that you can choose, well, first of all, you can always choose coordinates that the locally, so the volume form looks like dx1 wedge dx2, and then it turns out you can choose that you can define an endomorphism of the tangent bundle that maps d by dx1, the tangent vector in the x1 direction, to minus d by dx2 and plus d by dx2 and d by dx2 to minus d by dx1, and that's called an almost any that J has square minus 1, and any endomorphism of the tangent bundle with square minus 1 is called an almost complex structure. Now, in this case, they're locally complex coordinates. That's to say that you can choose a chart, you can find charts which map you to R2, which you can then identify with C in such a way so that where they overlap, the overlap function G is a holomorphic function. And so you can consistently do complex geometry on these things. And that would allow you, if you could do complex geometry on these surfaces, that allows you, in fact, it's using the, you know, Riemann-Roch theorem and various tools from complex geometry, you can prove this classification theorem. So the analogy, what people were thinking about in four dimensions was that, well, the whole slew. In fact, for a long time, the only four-dimensional manifolds that we could sort of see in any explicit form were the complex surfaces. So, for example, you could look at the locus like the K3 surface, but you could look at the locus of some zeros of polynomials, say, equals zero in CP3 for any p, you know, p equal one is CP2, p equal two, etc. P equal four was the K3 surface, and so on and so on. And so that you had, you know, these complex surfaces, you had more general complex surfaces. And there's a whole theory, a classification of complex surfaces that people had developed, Kodaira and others. So the original conjecture was simply that if pi 1 of x, say, is trivial, then x could be written in a maybe unique way as a connect sum of some finite number. So x is either S4 with some number of, say. So, and the xi, or its orientation reversed cousin, is a complex surface. So that was the original, that was an old conjecture, but that turned out to be false. I mean, it was disproved by Gompf and Mravka. They found a K3, something in DK3, something homeomorphic to the K3 surface, which couldn't be a complex surface. Okay, so that's wrong. Okay, so the next conjecture said, well, look, you have let's forget the complex structure. Let's just imagine that you had.
Sorry.
Yeah.
What are the hypotheses? Is X supposed to be complex or?
No. The idea was that any simply connected four manifold could be written as a connect sum of pieces. Each piece is complex, or maybe it's complex after you change the orientation. So that was the conjecture, and it turns out to be wrong. Okay, there are, for example, K3, things that are homeomorphic to K3, which do not decompose as connect sums, and they're not complex surfaces, or orientation reversed complex surfaces. Okay, neither way. So it's not right, not good enough. Okay, so the next idea was, instead of generalizing the idea of a complex structure, let's generalize the idea of having a two form which is non-degenerate. That's a symplectic form. So sort of thought was, well, let's define what we mean by a symplectic manifold, and I'm going to say a lot more about symplectic manifolds, because they seem to, they maybe play a big role in the story. So symplectic manifold, a four manifold, so these are all in dimension four, comes with a two form. So this is a two form omega, and it's closed, and it's never zero. So that means the four form omega wedge omega is always positive. So it gives you the orientation. Okay, so that's a symplectic manifold, and any, for example, Kähler manifold is symplectic because it has a Kähler form, which has this property. So the idea was, well, forget the complex structure part. Let's just keep the symplectic part. You see, you couldn't necessarily throw away the symplectic part and keep the complex part, because most, you know, the simply connected complex surfaces are Kähler, so you'd automatically get the symplectic part back. So the idea would be to keep the symplectic part but throw away the other part. And so the conjecture would be, rather than saying this, your conjecture is a symplectic manifold. Okay, so this was a conjecture that I had the temerity to make, and it was the sort of one of these embarrassing conjectures where it's disproved like 2 weeks later. So you never want to make a conjecture that doesn't last more than a couple of years. Otherwise, it just just proves how stupid you are rather than how much foresight you had in posing a question that directed the field of research for 40 years. That's your goal. I mean, if you can't prove a big theorem, the next best thing to do is to state a conjecture that, you know, like Fermat or something that, or Poincaré that, you know, kind of everybody realizes is the right path to take, even though they don't know how to prove it. So that's sort of the second best thing to proving a big theorem, but I've sort of failed on that regard in my one attempt to make a big conjecture, so I've learned not to conjecture anymore. But anyway, the conjecture was this, and it was disproved by Zoltán Szabó. I forget how to spell Zoltán. How do you spell his last name? S-Z. Szabó. So, within a couple of weeks after restating this conjecture, Szabó found lots of counterexamples. So this used the Seiberg-Witten equations, which I won't say too much about, but a little bit maybe. Okay, so that's not, so this is also wrong. And so where we stand now is that nobody really has a reasonable conjecture for what four dimensions should be. You know, you might say another possibility is, well, complex surfaces, Kähler surfaces, these are, you know, there's this theorem of Yao and, you know, work by Tian and others, you know, so they all, one understands in some sense, you know, that they have sort of Einstein metrics. And furthermore, if you're thinking about, rather than make analogy to two dimensions, you can make the analogy to three dimensions, where Thurston's conjecture, you know, basically says that all three manifolds can be broken up into pieces that have canonical homogeneous metrics. Some of them Einstein and others not. But anyway, they're sort of canonical geometries. You could conjecture that the metric geometry was somehow canonical. And one idea would be, well, maybe all four manifolds can be written as connect sums that are Einstein. Well, Lebrun has lots and lots of now examples of four manifolds that are homeomorphic to Einstein manifolds but don't have Einstein metric. So somehow, you know, that route, nobody knows how to make. There's no reasonable conjecture in that direction either. So where we stand now is, in fact, we don't even have a reasonable conjecture as to what four-dimensional manifolds are. Okay. Now, on the other hand, I don't want to throw out symplectic, because symplectic, even though this conjecture is false, the symplectic manifolds do seem to play some kind of special role in four dimensions, even though we don't know what that role is. Even though we know, you know, the generic four manifold isn't symplectic, it is symplectic geometry does play a big role. So what I want to do for the next 10 minutes in this lecture, in the beginning of the second lecture today, is to describe a little bit about, just to remind you about symplectic geometry and remind you about some of the fundamental things, and then sort of get to sort of the bottom line as to why symplectic geometry it might be useful to four dimensions. So let's that's sort of the plan for the next little bit. Okay, so at this point, this sort of ends my introduction to four dimensions in terms of classification. The bottom line is there are no conjectures. I'd be happy to take conjectures privately from people if they want to make them. It's your chance to direct the field of research for the next... Oh, a man who's going to make a conjecture. Yeah.
Just sort of brave, sir. Elementary yeah. question, just to get an overview.
Yes.
At the topological level, such a connected sum decomposition just follows the direct sum decomposition of
that's
the
right.
form.
Yeah.
So that's completely understood.
That's right.
And so this is kind of like a refinement. You know that you can't go all the way down in the smooth category. You kind of want to go down and kind of stop and find kind of prime factors.
Right.
In the smooth category that come from some canonical smaller family like complex or symplectic.
Right.
Einstein
right.
or whatever.
Right. Right. I mean, Yeah, I mean, so the goal would be to find some canonical smaller family that you can build, that you understand, by the way. I mean, so for example, we don't understand the classification of symplectic manifolds. You know, so that's by itself another problem, which there are now new and very powerful tools developed by Donaldson and some of his, you know, other young people, Dennis O'Rourke, among others, that look like they're going to allow one to study symplectic manifolds and produce maybe a Kodaira-type classification. I'm not clear how complete it'll be, but in any event, there are very powerful tools, which I'll say something about, for that. But even if this symplectic conjecture were true, at present we don't have a very good understanding of symplectic manifolds. But even so, the strategy would be find some small subset of manifolds that you understand, and then, you know, maybe all four manifolds are built out of these smaller pieces in some canonical fashion. I mean, that's sort of the best one could hope for in understanding four dimensions. Yes?
Is there, when you make such a connected sum decomposition in four dimensions, is the factorization unique
No.
in the topological category?
In the topological category, it's unique. In the smooth category, it's not. For example, if you have two smooth four manifolds which are not diffeomorphic but homeomorphic, and you connect some enough S2 cross S2s to them, they become diffeomorphic. Okay. So one has to be very careful in stating a connect sum theorem. All right, so symplectic structures. So we're looking at four-dimensional manifolds with a closed two-form omega, which is nowhere zero, so it everywhere defines the orientation. All right, so the first thing about these guys is that there are no local invariants of symplectic forms. So any symplectic form, you can always choose, find a neighborhood of any point with an identification to R4, such that the symplectic form looks like the standard form on R4, which I'll take to be dx1 wedge dx2 plus dx3 dx4. So there are no local invariants. And the second thing is that there are no deformations, local deformations, homologically trivial deformations. So this is to say that if you have a family of symplectic forms, say smoothly parametrized family, so these are closed forms, so they define a cohomology class. With this, their cohomology class equal constant, so it doesn't move. If you have such a family, then in fact the N member of the family is the pullback by a diffeomorphism of the starting member. So in other words, the family really is only moving because you've made a change of coordinates on the manifold. So phi is a diffeomorphism. Okay, so this is known as, the proof of this is a trick due to Moser, which if you've never seen, let me outline it, because it's used to prove a lot. In fact, this theorem, the statement that any symplectic form can be written in this way, can be proved with a version of Moser's trick. So let me just explain how this trick works. So the idea is this. Suppose we wanted to find some family of diffeomorphisms which pulls this back to our standard guy. Well, we just differentiate this equation. And so omega t, being that omega t has constant cohomology class, its derivative is d of something. Okay, so its derivative is exact. And on the other hand, the derivative of a diffeomorphism is given by a vector field. And so the derivative, if I take the derivative of this side I'm looking at the Lie derivative by some vector field of omega t plus d of phi t star alpha t. Well, if I undo phi, you get an equation like this. So the question is, what is this? This is telling us how we should change. If we could find this a vector field that solved this equation, it would tell us how we could change the diffeomorphism to make this true at a slightly. If we can do this up to some time t, and then find vt, that would tell us sort of infinitesimally how to do it for some slightly bigger time. So the goal would be to find this one parameter family of vector fields. Okay. Well, how do you? Well, you look right. What is the equation for the Lie derivative? This is just the contraction of the vector field with d omega t plus d of the contraction of the vector field with omega t. Okay, but this is zero since omega t is closed, and so we have an equation that says d of vt contracted with omega t is alpha t, and so that one way to solve that equation would be to take vt contracted with omega t to be minus alpha t. And so the question is, can we solve that? Well, omega t, remember, omega wedge omega is zero, so as a symmetric anti-symmetric form, it's invertible. So I can invert this equation, and that says vt is just minus omega t inverse of alpha t. And so that tells me the vector field to use to change the diffeomorphism. So that's basically Moser's trick, and you can use it with some linear algebra to prove this theorem too. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second and important feature about symplectic manifolds, and this is the one that really made the whole subject explode. This was now 15 or 16 years ago. This was exploited by Gromov, is the relationship between symplectic manifolds and not complex manifolds, but almost complex manifolds. So as I mentioned before, you know, if you have a Kähler manifold, there's the Kähler form is a symplectic form and somehow natural with respect to the symplectic structure, with respect to the complex structure. Well, Gromov turned this around, or at least maybe this was well known before Gromov. I mean, it's a sort of straightforward fact, but wasn't, to my knowledge, exploited before Gromov exploited it, which is this. If you have a symplectic form, then you can always find an endomorphism of a tangent bundle whose square is minus 1, so that's an almost complex structure, and has the following additional feature, that this bilinear form is a Riemannian metric. Okay, and in fact, whenever I talk about a metric on a symplectic manifold with an almost complex structure, I'll be talking about this metric implicitly. So J doesn't have to be integrable. So there doesn't have to be, in fact, generally speaking, there won't be complex coordinates locally, but you can always find these J's with this property. And this is to say one says that J tames omega, or J is omega compatible, I guess is the right thing. And the point is you can always find these J's, and in fact some linear algebra tells you that the space of such J's is a contractible space. It has no topology in it. So you can choose any J. There's infinite dimensional families of J's that satisfy this. That's really just some linear algebra with a symplectic group. And the idea here is what Gromov said you should study when you have this kind of J is you should study some special surfaces. And so we're in particular interested in a closed or compact surface, two-dimensional surface in X, embedded surface in X, with the property that J maps its tangent space to itself. So generally, J will map the tangent space out of the tangent space, but this is a very special surface which is preserved, this tangent space is preserved by J, and this is called pseudo-holomorphic. So pseudo. And these surfaces play a very important role, and they have a nice rigidity properties, and they're based, and they're minimal surfaces for this metric, and I'll say a whole lot about them. But the basic strategy and the basic sort of idea for using this sort of complex, these are in a way they look like complex surfaces in complex manifolds. The idea here is that these surfaces provide, on the one hand, if you can count these surfaces in a clever way, they give invariance to the manifold. And on the other hand, if you have families of these surfaces, they sweep out, in a sense, they give you complex coordinates. And I put that in quotes because it's not a complex manifold, but they give you somehow canonical coordinates on the manifold. So the idea, the strategy for using them is, on the one hand, counting them to get invariance, on the other hand, using families of them to sweep out a manifold, make it look like some kind of singular fibration. So those are sort of the two directions in which one uses these kinds of surfaces. Anyway, so I'm going to start my second lecture by talking about these pseudo-holomorphic surfaces. And I guess I should stop now and give you guys a break for 10 minutes. Okay.